How many of you remember terms like isosceles triangle and hypotenuse? Do they bring shivers to you, remembering your old courses in mathematics somewhere along the line? Or do they bring joy? Well, my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is definitely takes joy. In fact, he would say that without terms like those, civilization wouldn't be what it is. Am I right about that, Bob?
Correct. Bill? Yes, correct.
My guest this evening, I'm John Pierce, and this is Lehigh Valley Discourse. Dr. William Dunham has been a historian of mathematics, a professor, and an author. He received his undergraduate degree from the University of Pittsburgh, followed by a Master of Science and PhD from The Ohio State University. Bill, would you take umbrage if I said go blue at this point?
Yes, I would.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Then I won't say it.
Okay.
Dr. Dunham has written 4 books on the history of mathematics. This is what I find really interesting about you, is that not only a professor of mathematics, using these arcane terms that I mentioned at the beginning of the broadcast, but that you have become so interested in the history of mathematics. So I'm supposing that the mathematics itself came first in your life, and suddenly, or maybe little by little, you got interested in history.
Right? It was sort of a joint development. I always had loved history. When I went to college, I was either going to study that or mathematics. And it was not clear which route I would take, but I ended up in math. And as you described, went to the Ohio State University and got the PhD, went and taught at a small college in Indiana where nobody else knew what I did, you know, my particular area of mathematics. And I started to feel sort of isolated and, you know, stale, and I needed something to rejuvenate my batteries. And history. I remembered I had loved history, and now I knew mathematics, and so that's when I put this together. It was sort of a surprise in that sense, but it worked for me. It's exactly the two things I most was interested in.
And that was the early in your teaching career.
That's right. Yeah, I was 30 years old or something. I'd been teaching a few years at a place called Hanover College in Indiana, the alma mater of Woody Harrelson. So there you go.
Oh, all right.
But it was just such a small and isolated place that you were pretty much on your own.
And what was your particular field in mathematics that they didn't understand?
It was called general topology. So it was a pretty abstract, you know, subject. It was good to get a PhD. It was the route that I took, and I had a good advisor, and you did your research and all that. But it was not the sort of thing that makes your refrigerator run better or anything like that. So it was a little abstract for most people's taste.
I've never run across a PhD topic that would make the refrigerator run better, Bill. That's a great image.
Yeah.
So Dr. Dunham has written 4 books. Let me give you the titles: Journey Through Genius, The Mathematical Universe, Euler, The Master of Us All, and The Calculus Gallery. Who was Euler?
I have to interrupt. He was Euler.
Euler,
yes,
sorry.
Right. Yes,
all right.
That's the
Thank
way
you for the, yeah, yeah. For the.
Who was Euler? Well, he was one of the great mathematicians ever, and he should be known by everybody. This is my sense. Okay. Instead, if people know him, it's often because he shows up in a crossword puzzle because he's got 3 vowels and 5 letters. But Euler was a Swiss mathematician from the 18th century. He was the most prolific mathematician ever in terms of the number of papers and books that he wrote. And he was also one of the most insightful. The quality of his work is just as awesome as the quantity of it. He is my favorite mathematician, and everybody should. Oh, he's Shakespeare. Let me put it that way. If you're in literature, you know Shakespeare. If you're in mathematics, you know Euler.
You automatically know Euler.
In the same way.
And yes. I pronounced it Euler because it's spelled E-U-L-E-R, and that's a Swiss pronunciation.
That's right.
Would be Euler.
Yeah.
Good. Dr. Dunham recently co-edited, along with Don Albers and Jerry Alexanderson, an anthology called The G.H. Hardy Reader. Now, what does that title mean exactly? Explain a little bit.
G.H. Hardy was a mathematician, a Cambridge mathematician, active in the first half of the 20th century. He was an amazing guy, brilliant mathematician, but also one of these Brits with a wry sense of humor and the ability to write beautifully. There's been a line of these British scientists. I think you might know Bertrand Russell.
Sure.
He won the Nobel Prize in literature in 1950, but he was a mathematician originally. And Lewis Carroll, who wrote, you know, Alice in Wonderland, was actually a mathematician at Oxford.
Oh.
And it even extends to Charles Darwin. I don't know if you've read The Origin of Species, but Darwin was a brilliant writer. So Hardy was a great mathematical thinker, but he would write beautiful prose. And what we did, Don and Jerry and I, is we assembled some of his writings, not necessarily the technical math ones, but just Hardy being funny and witty and acerbic and all these other things that he would be, and put them into the G.H. Hardy Reader. One other thing about Hardy, maybe some of your listeners saw the movie The Man Who Knew Infinity. It came out in 2016, and in it, Jeremy Irons plays G.H. Hardy, so he's one of the stars. But the real star is this Indian mathematician named Srinivasa Ramanujan, played by Dev Patel. And it's the story of Hardy, the senior British intellectual, and Ramanujan, this sort of untrained Indian clerk who has an incandescent genius in mathematics somehow. He writes Hardy a letter and says, you know, here's what I know. And Hardy immediately says, we have to bring this person to Cambridge. This is a once-in-a-generation mathematician. Wow. And the movie is about those two. But the book that you cited, The G.H. Hardy Reader, has a lot in it also about Ramanujan and this sort of amazing relationship between these two very different people.
So Dr. William Dunham, my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, was George, now help me with the pronunciation, Polya,
mm-hmm.
lecturer for a couple of years, and is featured in the Teaching Company's DVD course, Great Thinkers, Great Theorems. Now, the Teaching Company, that's a title of the company.
Yes, that's right. I think they've changed their name to The Great Courses.
I've seen that advertised.
And you get these little DVDs in plastic cases right. of courses on, you know, Michelangelo or the Civil yeah. War or something.
Exactly. So you're in that series.
I am.
For Great Thinkers, Great Theorems.
Yes, I filmed that in 2010, and it was quite an experience.
Where did you go to do that?
Their studios are down in Chantilly, Virginia, and you're contracted to present 24 half-hour lectures, and mine were supposed to span the history of mathematics. So my initial thought was, well, how hard can this be? You know, I was a professor at Muhlenberg College. I give lectures all the time. But when you do it under the constraints of being filmed with three cameras and little lights blinking on and off telling you which camera to look at and, you know, restrictions on where you can walk and where you can put your hands and most seriously with this giant clock going at the back of the studio, which starts at 30 minutes and runs down, and you have to end within 15 seconds of 30 minutes. They do not want their lectures to fall short or long. And so while you're talking and trying to remember the math and trying to remember where to put your hands and all this and which camera to look at, you're also calculating all along, how am I doing in terms of hitting this right on the head?
And you have 1 minute to go and you suddenly have to wrap it up.
That's right. Yes, so. Right. So if you have 1 minute to go and you have lots to say, you start talking very fast. Or if you've already said everything, then you slow down. But they're very adamant about that, strict about that. It was really quite challenging to do something like that. I'm glad I did it, but it was not trivial.
Yeah, what an experience.
Yeah.
Well, Bill has already mentioned that he taught at Muhlenberg College. That was 22 years. And He held visiting positions also at Harvard, Princeton, Cornell, the University of Pennsylvania. And then you got tired of the Ivy League and you decided to go to Bryn Mawr.
Right.
You went for the main line.
Yes.
So, and is presently a research associate in mathematics at Bryn Mawr. Now, I'm curious, Bill, what is a research associate? What do you do with that title?
Well, it's an affiliation. We moved on when we retired from Muhlenberg, my wife Penny and I.
Let's give a shout out to Penny because she also teaches mathematics.
That's right. Yes, we met in graduate school in mathematics in the summer of 1969. It's hard to imagine anything more romantic, right, than being in a class of number theory together, but that's how we got started. And Muhlenberg was nice enough to give us both positions. So we were there 22 years at Muhlenberg, both of us in the math department there. But when we retired, we headed to the main line, to Bryn Mawr, and we're about three blocks from Bryn Mawr College. So we just inquired, is there any way we could get a kind of loose affiliation? And they were kind enough to give us what's called research associateship. So we have a library card. We go to the colloquium. We can hang out on campus.
You don't do any teaching at this point?
Not usually, although last semester, both Penny and I did each teach one course at Bryn Mawr. So I taught the history of math, which isn't a surprise, I guess. And Penny had developed a course at Muhlenberg on cryptography, on the mathematics of codes. Every time you put your credit card in the machine, something gets encrypted. And how in the world does that work? And it's very sophisticated mathematically. So she took her Muhlenberg course down to Bryn Mawr and taught that. So we both had this opportunity to teach a really interesting college. Bryn Mawr is very different, but I was quite impressed.
Yes, yes, indeed. And Bryn Mawr and Swarthmore and third?
Haverford
are all there in that area.
That's right.
And they're all very well respected.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah, Bryn Mawr and Haverford are particularly nearby geographically, and there's a little bus that runs back and forth, so the students can take courses at either campus. And thus, you might have a male in your class at Bryn Mawr because he's come over from Haverford. Although I didn't. I had only women.
So Bryn Mawr is still female.
Undergraduate, it's all female. There is a small graduate program, which is co-ed, but the actual undergrads are all women. And some very remarkable ones, I can tell you.
My guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse is Dr. William Dunham, a former colleague of mine at Muhlenberg College. And our engineer for this program is a graduate of Muhlenberg. So we have a little Muhlenberg get-together going today here. That's Neil Heaver. And he's our operations director here at WDIY. Well, Bill wanted me to ask the question here, where did mathematics get started? It almost is the question, why do we even need mathematics?
Well, the distant origins certainly go back into prehistory, and there's a lot of speculation as to how it actually got started. It seems like humans are going to have two challenges are going to be addressing no matter where you are, no matter what civilization. One of them is quantity, number, counting. And one of them is space, geometry, And it seems like for us as a species, we're going to have to come to grips with each of these. There's a very interesting artifact found in Africa called the Lebombo bone, L-E-B-O-M-B-O, a bone found in Swaziland about 40,000 years ago, they've dated it, on which you'll find these little scoring, these little marks, little vertical lines, lots of them, side by side. What is this? Well, nobody's quite sure, but it sure looks like someone's been making a tally. Someone's been counting something.
Could be days.
Could be days. It could be sheep. It could be, who knows, people in the village. But if so, then we have, a very ancient bit of evidence that people knew how to count. They knew mathematics in the sense of number. And that's intriguing to me. I imagine that these same people, whoever they were singing, but we don't have their songs. You know, mm-hmm. maybe they were telling stories, but we don't have stories.
Whatever.
Dancing, but we don't have that. That's lost. Mm-hmm. But we have some record that they could count. So counting, number, which sort of becomes arithmetic, if you will, you know, that seems to be quite old. But then there's geometry, the study of space. And here we find that certainly in the Egyptian civilization, you know, 3, 4,000 B.C., the story there would be that the Nile would flood, and then the floods would recede, and you had to be able to recover where your land was, you know, where's your property lines. That's geometry. And they certainly knew things about pyramids there, and that's geometry too. So by the time of the Egyptians, we have these two branches of mathematics in their incipient form, the number, the arithmetic, the counting, and then the space, the geometry. And you know, you can trace those along right up to the present day.
And you say going back as far as 40,000 years ago.
Yeah.
In Africa.
Yep.
Amazing. So how about ancient Greek mathematicians, Euclid, Archimedes? Why are they so important?
Yeah, so the history of mathematics has this sort of ancient part I just mentioned. And I should also toss out the Babylonians did a lot with numbers. But things really get started when you get to the Greeks. And the reason is the Greeks proved theorems. They didn't just describe things that they saw. They didn't just count things up, but they proved theorems. And that becomes sort of the heart and soul of modern mathematics. So you can trace that aspect of it back to the Greeks.
Do the Greeks make claims that they indeed were the first mathematicians?
I don't quite remember that exactly, but we certainly know that they were influenced by the Egyptians and the Babylonians. And I should also mention there was a Chinese mathematics going at about the same time, although it's not clear that there was any influence in the sense that people from China didn't get to the Mediterranean or vice versa. But the Greeks were pretty proud of what they did. You know, we think of Greek civilization as being the start of theater, perhaps, the start of political theory or philosophy, and all of that's true. But
for the West, at least.
For the West, that's right. But for the West also, we shouldn't forget, this is also where serious mathematics got started.
Mm-hmm. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse. My name is John Pierce, your host, and I'm speaking this evening with Dr. William Dunham, who is a professor of mathematics and a mathematics historian. Would you say that you are, if I say mathematics historian, that means you're more of a historian than mathematician?
Right. That's probably backwards.
Okay.
Yeah, because I think I'm less of a historian than mathematician.
A historical mathematician.
Yes, we'll do it that way.
Okay. All right. And when we come back from our break, I'm going to put a challenge to Bill, something that I heard years ago with one of my math teachers saying, next time we meet, I will show you that, and we think about numbers as being odd or even. Should I be saying integers instead of numbers there?
Probably, yep.
All right, we have odd and even integers. And so I'm going to challenge you to tell our listeners when we come back from our break that there are just as many even integers as there are total integers.
Oh.
So we give you just a couple of minutes to think about that, Bill.
Okay.
So this is Lehigh Valley Discourse. Time for us to take a break. And we will be talking more about the history of mathematics when we return.
Spread the word about your organization or business to a well-informed audience. Become an underwriter with WDIY. Our lineup of NPR News and locally produced music programs reaches thousands of locally engaged listeners each day. Underwriting on WDIY is an affordable way to enhance your image and to provide information about your services to people who care. To learn more about underwriting opportunities, call 610-694-8100, extension 6, or visit our website, wdiy.org.
Dr. William Dunham, there is the challenge. What is your answer to that? Can there be as many even integers as total integers?
Right. It seems impossible, right? But one of the questions we first must ask is this. What does it mean to say that two collections have as many elements, that one collection has as many elements as the other, so they have the same size, if you will? And that might seem trivial because let's say I want to know if I have the same number of fingers on my right hand as on my left, right? So we would just count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on my right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 on my left, and would say, yes, same number. What if you couldn't count? And you still had to answer that for the fingers. What mathematicians would say is just match them up.
Okay.
Put your hands together, thumb on thumb, index on index, right, and so on. And each finger on your right hand has a mate on your left and vice versa. So even though I can't count to five, say, I nonetheless know that those two sets of fingers have the same number of fingers, right? Okay. Now, so let's say we buy that definition, if you will. So now we're going to look at the even numbers, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, versus all the numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and say that they have the same number of items in them. How are we going to do that? Well, let's do a matching, just like the fingers. I'm going to start with all the numbers. I'm going to match 1 with 2 among the evens. So all the numbers, the number 1 matches with the even number 2. From among all the numbers, I get to 2. I'm going to match it with 4 among the evens. 3 from the set of all numbers matches with 6 among the evens. 4 matches with 8. 5 with 10. Suppose you do this for everybody. Now, is this not a perfect correspondence, a perfect matching, just like with my fingers? Does every number, every integer, have a mate among the evens? You know, so like what's going to be matched with 7 among the evens?
All right, 14.
14, all right. So every number has a mate among the evens. How about backwards? Does every even have a mate back among all the numbers? What is 16 matched with?
With?
As we go backwards.
16. Now, wait a second. I'm thinking 8, but see,
that's right. 8, yeah.
All right.
It's because the 8 doubles to 16, but yes, when you go the other way, 16 halves to 8. So as the mathematician would say, the integer n, which whatever it is, matches with the even integer 2n. You just double. Right. Well, if you think about that, every integer has exactly one even it's matched with. Every even has exactly one integer it's matched with. And it's just like the fingers of my right hand and the fingers of my left hand. And if you believe that I have as many fingers on my right hand as on my left hand because I can match them into this one-to-one correspondence, then you've got to concede that there's as many integers as there are even integers because I've just matched them in a similar one-to-one correspondence. Right. And that's the argument. So
okay,
there.
That was a really long explanation of what I remember was that the thinking is if you're saying between 0 and 100, are there as many even as total, then the answer would be no.
Absolutely, correct.
But that's the way we tend to think.
Yes. You know?
But if they're both both even and total.
That, right, you allow the whole infinite collection.
Infinite,
right.
Well, then infinite says it all.
When you move into the infinite realm, things start going crazy. Yeah.
Let's get back to history a little bit. So why are the ancient we talked about the ancient Greek mathematicians and their importance, and you said that instead of merely counting things, the Greeks brought us into the realm of proving.
Yes.
Okay. Now, let me just mention the book that I have in my hand right here, thanks to Bill, is called The Mathematical Universe by William Dunham, An Alphabetical Journey Through the Great Proofs, Problems, and Personalities. You got the three P's in there. that's terrific.
Yeah.
And one of the comments that you make in here is that in order to prove, a mathematician can't just make 3 or 4 or 5 proofs. He has to make all proofs possible. Did I get that right?
I'm not quite sure yet. I'm following her. Make okay. all proofs
that,
possible.
That he has to keep on proving whatever it is, almost ad infinitum, in order to say this is a certainty.
No, I think I'd go there because okay. Nobody has that much time in their lives to do that.
Exactly.
Right. Now, what a mathematician can do is somehow extract some general principles, use his or her mind, and concoct an argument that settles an infinite number of cases in a single finite argument. Famous example, I would say, we were mentioning the Greeks, let's go to the Pythagorean theorem. So your listeners might remember this from school. A right triangle has a square corner. If one of those sides is of length A, one of the legs is of length A, the vertical side. Let's imagine it's standing vertically. So the vertical side A, the horizontal side of length B, and then that diagonal third side, which is called the hypotenuse, of length C. And the Pythagorean theorem says that C squared, C times C, is always equal to A squared plus B squared. That the square on the hypotenuse is the sum of the squares on the legs, as they sometimes say. Well, now that's been proved. Euclid proves this, meaning he starts with the basic axioms of his system, very self-evident concepts, and then starts reasoning and deducing and arguing in a perfectly rigorous logical fashion until he gets to a proof of that theorem, which is true for all right triangles. No matter what A, B, and C are, this relationship's going to hold. C squared is A squared plus B squared. So in a sense, he's done it for infinitely many triangles that are possible, but a finite argument, argument, handles it. And there's other examples. Here's a real simple one. You could prove that if you take two even numbers and add them together, you get an even number.
Okay, right.
Now, you don't have to check every pair of evens forever and ever to do that because that would be impossible.
Get into the millions and trillions
and in fact, infinitely many. Yeah. But you can make a short argument once you've defined what even numbers are that establish that. So now I would know that no matter what pair of evens you bring me, their sum's going to be even because I proved it in general. So you can see the power of this. If you can do it, you get in a finite argument that a human being can actually understand, you can cover infinitely many cases that will be good forever. And once you prove this, it's proved. There's a quotation in one of my books from a 19th century writer that says, logic can be patient for it is eternal.
Mm-hmm.
And an argument once proved is proved forever.
All right. Now, you use the example of two even integers being added together. It's always going to give you an even integer.
Always.
So my logic would say two odd integers added together are always going to give you an odd result. And that's not true.
No.
What happened?
Right. Well, the theorem can be your theorem, the John Pierce theorem you've just proposed, can be shot down by something called a counterexample. So when a mathematician makes a statement that it's always the case that something happens, if that is false, all you need is a single example to show it. So you want two odds that add up. Two odds always add to an odd.
That's right. So we take 3 + 3 and we get six, which doesn't happen to be an odd integer.
And so that kills the John Pierce theorem, I'm afraid. Sum of two odds is always even, and that too can be proved.
So the sum of either two evens or two odds is always going to be even.
Correct. The only way you can add two things and get an odd is if there's one of each.
Okay. Dr. William Dunham is my guest this evening on Lehigh Valley Discourse, and we're talking about the history of mathematics. Bill, you talk about classical civilization falling and what happened to mathematics at that point.
Yeah, there was these great achievements of the Greeks. You had mentioned Euclid, Archimedes, Heron, other big names that did amazing things back in classical times, but then it all collapses and it could have been lost. The salvation were the Arabic scholars, the Muslim scholars in the great age of Islam, who took some of this stuff back to Baghdad, which is actually their Harvard, if you will, the center of learning in the Islamic world. And they translated the Greek documents, and they commented on the Greek documents, and they augmented them. And therefore, the great achievements of Archimedes and Euclid are still known to us. They, you know, they could have all been burned up when the library at Alexandria burned, or they could have been lost at sea or something. But the Islamic mathematicians not only had their own rich mathematics, but they preserved the Greek mathematics, and they also were sort of in between the European civilizations and India. So they also absorbed mathematics from the Indian subcontinent, which had its own rich mathematical tradition. So the Arabic world was sort of the center of this wheel, if you will, that with axes going off in various directions. And for a long time, that was the center of mathematics on Earth. If you came from Mars in the year 800 and says, take me to the heart of your mathematical civilization, you would go to Baghdad.
All right. And so we have Roman numerals on the one hand. Thank goodness we're not using those anymore. I don't know how we would deal with multiplications of numbers like that.
Yes, that's right.
And then we have what we call Arabic numbers or integers. Now, there's something special about the number zero.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. That was not right from the beginning.
No,
was it?
No, that was sort of a controversial thing. That you know, a number is supposed to indicate what a multitude of things, and if zero is there, there is no multitude.
There you go. And if you're starting off with the very basic, well, let's count how many days there are in the month, and so on, you're not going to have zero.
That's right. Yeah.
Until you get to 10.
Yeah. Right, and that's in the Hindu-Arabic number system, you need it for the 10. Now, in Romans, you just make it an X, you know, so
yes.
You don't need that zero.
Right.
So that innovation of adding the zero came from India in the first millennium. So by the year 1000, there was a zero. In the year 100, there wasn't, you know, and they can look at these temple carvings in India, and they can sort of see numbers that look sort of like ours for 7 and 3. But suddenly, somewhere around the year 700, 800, there's this little circle, and that's the zero. And so it also showed up in the Mayan number system here on this side of the Atlantic. But the real number system that we use, which, you know, when you learn at school with the digits that we're familiar with and the zero to hold the places, we call that the Hindu-Arabic system, but it's really Hindu. And the Arabs knew this, that that was one of those things they had borrowed. They had come upon it in India. They said, this really works great. And they taught it to the people in Baghdad and in the Middle East. And they called them the Hindu numbers.
Oh.
But then when the Europeans have the Renaissance and this knowledge filters back to Europe, it got labeled the Hindu-Arabic numerals because they got it via the Arabs. But this really is an innovation that we owe to the Indians.
To the Indians.
Yeah.
Interesting. I want to read just a very short passage from Dr. William Dunham's book, The Mathematical Universe, just to show you folks out there who think that the words mathematician and sense of humor are an oxymoron, just to prove that that's not the case. So here is in one of his chapters, which is called Mathematical Personality, Dr. Dunham states, not everyone is convinced of absent-mindedness as a chronic affliction of mathematicians. But in the interest of fairness, we briefly mentioned the opposing viewpoint of John F. Bowers of the University of Leeds. In a provocative article about the eccentricities of mathematicians, Bowers bucked the prevailing wisdom by declaring unequivocally the idea that mathematicians are absent-minded is absolutely wrong. There is a conclusive proof that shows that they are not, but unfortunately it cannot be given here because it seems to have been mislaid. You have to be able not to take yourself too seriously when you write something like that.
Yes, that's right.
Now, is it absent-minded mathematician, would you say, just as much as I've always heard the term absent-minded professor?
Right,
whatever
yes.
You're professing.
That's right. Although, I don't know, maybe absent-minded economist is a little more rare than an absent-minded mathematician. It's hard to say. I haven't done a study of this. But yeah, some mathematicians can be pretty absent-minded. You know, if you spend your time thinking about prime numbers and equilateral triangles, you're sort of off in some strange ethereal world, and maybe the day-to-day challenges just are too much for you. And I've lived among mathematicians for all these decades, and I can say there's a good bit of absent-mindedness there.
Are they mostly able to, these mathematicians, able to laugh at themselves about it?
Some don't even realize, I guess, how how strange their behavior is. There's the famous story of Archimedes. I guess everyone knows the Eureka story, where he was in the bath when he got this great idea, and he had found it. That's what Eureka means. You know, I've discovered it. And he jumps from the bath and runs through the streets of Syracuse in Sicily, his native land, shouting, "Eureka, Eureka," but he forgot to put on his toga. You know, this was just, he was absent-minded. And so he didn't get arrested for public indecency, I guess. But he did give us not only the first Eureka moment, but this is how streaking was invented.
That's what was that Eureka about?
It was a problem about hydrostatics. The king of Syracuse had given some gold to a goldsmith to make a crown. When the crown came back, the king thought that the goldsmith had substituted a lesser alloy and it wasn't pure gold. So the challenge to Archimedes was to determine whether this crown was pure gold or something else. And he did this by immersing it in water. And he got the idea when he himself was immersed in water in this bath and jumped out excited that he'd solved his problem.
He had solved, yeah. And indeed he had solved it.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Archimedes, one of the great mathematicians of all times, and we're talking about several of these with Dr. William Dunham, who is a historical mathematician, right, instead of a mathematics historian. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, serving the Lehigh Valley and beyond. It's about time for us to take another break, and when we come back, I'm going to tell you something about musical theater and mathematics, because there is something in there, Bill, even though Bill is looking at me as if I'm a little bit loopy. Maybe at heart I'm a mathematician. So stay with us. We'll be back in 60 seconds.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Some of you probably know of Gilbert and Sullivan's Pirates of Penzance. And one of my favorite characters, Bill, in all of musical theater is the modern Major General, who knows nothing about making warfare and leading troops into battle and so on, but he has this marvelous classical education. So he can quote the croaking chorus from the frogs of Aristophanes, and he can do many things, all the kings of England in order, and recite them. And he says, "I'm very well acquainted, too, with matters mathematical. I understand equations, both the simple and quadratical. About binomial theorem, I'm teeming with a lot of news, with many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. I'm very good at integral and differential calculus. I know the scientific names of beings animalculous. In short, in matters vegetable, animal, and mineral, I am the very model of a modern Major General." Now, after I've just recited that, I'm going to ask Neil if I have his permission to do my rendition of "Poor Wandering One." Does that fit into it? No. He is vehemently shaking his head. All right. So When the modern major general says, I'm teeming with a lot of news and many cheerful facts about the square of the hypotenuse. I challenge you, William Dunham, to give us one cheerful fact about the square of the hypotenuse. Well,
it's that Pythagorean theorem again, right? The square of the hypotenuse is the sum of the squares on the legs. And Euclid proved that.
All right. And why is that so joyful? Why should we be excited about that?
Well, it's so strange. Why should it be? You have a right triangle, that long side, the hypotenuse, take that length, multiply it by itself, and you get exactly what you get if you take those other two legs and multiply them by themselves and add it. It's just sort of stunningly strange. We get used to it because you learn it in school, and if you've studied trigonometry, trig is all about the Pythagorean theorem. That's basically it, dressed up in various guises. But the Pythagorean theorem is as great a theorem as there is, I think, and it's been around a long time.
This might be a tough question, but it occurs to me, how much of math? Sometimes when I think of mathematics, I think of mental gymnastics that are not applicable in the world in which we live, except for just thinking about them. Can you put a percentage on how much of mathematics is like that and how much actually helps you build a house or solve a problem out there in the world?
Well, I'm tempted to say that 90% of math is just mental gymnastics and the other 20% is applied. but I'll resist that.
They're 110%. Right?
No, that's always been a dichotomy in mathematics. There are some who only want those applications. And certainly, you know, students appreciate seeing how this mathematical theory applies to economics or statistical reasoning or engineering. But then other mathematicians just like the pure joy of studying things like the Pythagorean theorem and seeing the relationship among the hypotenuse and the legs, regardless of whether that helps you in the real world. Mathematicians don't want to be constrained only studying things that have an obvious application. You know, they want to be able to let their minds roam freely. But strangely enough, sometimes the most abstract, the least applied concepts turned out to have real applications. And the best example right now is the theory of numbers, number theory, which is this very abstract thing about prime numbers and composite numbers and even numbers and odd numbers, about whole numbers, is at the basis of how your credit card encrypts your information nowadays. Whenever you put your credit card into a machine, they don't want to transmit that number. They want to encode it. And they encode it by using some very sophisticated number theory. Out comes what looks like gibberish. That goes to the bank. They decrypt it using their own mathematical information, and there's your credit card number. How that encryption happens is from number theory, which for centuries was regarded as the least applied subject imaginable. And yet there it is. So you just never know where an application could appear.
There's reason right there to keep on thinking and
that's right.
Keep on playing with the numbers yeah. out there. Let's talk a little bit about the mathematicians that you've mentioned through history who are really important. Didn't hear any women's names in there. What about women in mathematics?
Yeah, so that's been an issue. Women have been discouraged from doing mathematics for centuries and centuries. You know, it's not a happy story. If you look back through history, people like Immanuel Kant, the great philosopher, said that a woman might as well grow a beard as study geometry. He thought this was something that was out of her, you know, capabilities. This is not true. I can report. I taught at Bryn Mawr College last term, where all my students were women. But you know, this was the attitude, and this can permeate a young girl's opinion of herself and her abilities. Plus, women weren't allowed even to go to university. You know, as math gets more and more sophisticated, you really need training. You really need to go to college and university and study with great mathematicians. And there's all kinds of stories in the 19th century and before, women who had that ability, but They weren't allowed in the classroom. They literally, the door was slammed in their face. And a woman named Sophie Germain, a French mathematician from the early 19th century, would take to eavesdropping. She'd, when the lecture was going on, she'd try to crack the door open and hear what was happening, because if she walked in, she would be kicked out. And even when you had that training and you overcame the prejudices, I'm thinking of a woman named Emmy Noether, N-O-E-T-H-E-R, who was the great algebraist of the 20th century. She tried to get a job, and it was refused. You know, the math faculty in Germany, this was, said, we can't have a woman on our faculty, you know, in mathematics. And one of their number, who was sympathetic to Emmy, stood up and says, gentlemen, this is a university, not a bathing establishment. If she has the talent, she should be able to work here. So these kind of roadblocks have been around for a very long time. Now, I'm hopeful that they will fall. I think there's signs that they are falling. In 100 years, maybe this issue won't be so obvious.
Well, your wife, Penny, is a good example of how she pursued mathematics, even though maybe by her family's standards, they thought she was making a mistake or it wasn't quite right.
Yeah, right. We know people who were told, you know, this one girl who was in my son's high school was very talented. She wanted to be an engineer and thus wanted to take the advanced math courses. And she was told, no, you're a girl. What do you need that for?
And this is only a couple of decades
ago. Yeah, this was not ancient history, right? Mm-hmm. That has a happy ending. She insisted. She took the advanced math, went to Purdue, and now she's a working engineer at Cummins Diesel in Indiana. So you know, you can overcome this. And I hope these roadblocks fall. You know, you don't want to exclude half the population just instantly because they're female. That makes no sense. Mathematical talent, especially at a level like Emmy Noether or somebody of that caliber, is just so rare. You need it no matter where it's coming from.
Now, when you think back on your years at Muhlenberg College, the 22 years, and you think about the students who came through your courses, was the great majority male?
No. At Muhlenberg, we would have about a 50-50 breakdown in terms of math majors. And some of my favorite students there were female. So Muhlenberg did a pretty good job of it. But if I go back to the beginning of my career at another institution, then it was a little more male. I think it's been, you know, it's been evolving.
Mm-hmm. And what about when you think about your colleagues in mathematics departments? Would that be overwhelmingly male?
And it would have been, yeah. And certainly when I went to graduate school at Ohio State, there were very few women on that faculty. But nowadays at Muhlenberg, I think it's about 50-50. And at Bryn Mawr, it's, you know, more women than men on the faculty. So
more women than men in mathematics?
Yes. Yes. At Bryn Mawr, math is the largest major at that college. Oh. There's 130 women studying mathematics at Bryn Mawr out of a student body of 1,100. So they're not dissuaded. Now, one thing that sometimes happens is if there's men around, then they can put out a certain pressure on the women, you know, that not to do this, not to invade their space, if you will. If you're at a women's college like Bryn Mawr, or where my wife Penny went, was a women's college, then everybody's a math major. You know, I mean, every math major is a woman, excuse me, because every student is. So that might help a bit. But in any event, let's hope this is a problem that's going to go away.
So Dr. William Dunham, my guest here on Lehigh Valley Discourse, is answering some really interesting points about the history of mathematics. Here's one, Bill. Is the area of mathematics finished now, or is there a promise of new developments?
Yeah, I think it's possible, I guess, from going to school and taking math to think that it's all been done, but it certainly hasn't. There's universities where research is going on. We're right near the campus of Lehigh here as we do this, and there's a whole bunch of research mathematicians there. Sometimes they're working on old branches of the subject, number theory, you know, analysis. Sometimes they're inventing new ones. New branches come into play. Operations research is one that was a 20th century development. Graph theory was a 20th century development. And who knows what the 21st century will bring. It's a subject that is still chugging along.
And I would imagine it has such a long history that, and their progress as you went along and new developments and new theories coming along, that is simply going to go into the future as well. What about the role of computers? Have computers made mathematicians obsolete? Ooh, I don't even like to ask you that question.
Right, which is a question you hear. You know, computers are incredibly powerful. But let's think back to my theorem from a few segments ago that the sum of two even numbers is even, right? So the mathematician can prove this in a few lines. Suppose you turn a computer loose and it takes two even numbers and adds them up, and then two others and adds them up and it comes out even, and then it does a million of them and it comes out even. It does a billion and a trillion. Suppose you've done a trillion cases and it always is true that the sum of two evens is even. How many more numbers do you have to check if you're that computer? Well, even if you've done a trillion, there's infinitely many numbers. You haven't even started. So now you get a trillion computers working on it, and you do a trillion numbers. You haven't even started. The computer is limited, in at least in terms of checking things, to a finite, even if it's a very vast, it's a finite number of examples it can treat. And a mathematician can treat infinitely many by the power of his or her mind. So I don't think mathematicians are going out of business.
Maybe it's a question of speed in many people's minds, because a computer can do things much more quickly.
Oh, right. Yeah, if you want to add up, you know, 50 eight-digit numbers, let a computer do it, right? But mathematics isn't just that.
From Dr. Dunham's book, The Mathematical Universe, here's a little tidbit that I like. Just this again is to show sense of humor. When people spend years thinking continually about such things as a distribution of prime numbers or the trisection of angles, it is little wonder they neglect to comb their hair. I think about the famous picture of Albert Einstein when that said. I think he probably didn't even own a comb. The material world begins to seem so trivial, so arbitrary, so ephemeral when contrasted with the timeless beauty of mathematics. Uh-huh. Oh, the timeless beauty of mathematics. It is not surprising that mathematicians forget to put out the cat. Indeed, they often forget they own a cat. Their bodies may be resting comfortably in an armchair, but their minds are wandering through very different realms. That is really well said.
Well, thank you.
And you picture the person who just... Sometimes I think, Bill, that when you take a look at conversation that we all have during our lives, most of the things are so uninteresting if you go back to revisit them. They're just little bits of what are we doing later and where's the car and all these things that mathematicians perhaps would find this very boring to be with people who are not other mathematicians.
Yeah, and that's not altogether true, but yes, you're right. There is a sort of bond among those people that love mathematics and can do it, and other things do sometimes seem a little trivial.
Now, you have a tease here for me, and that is that Dr. Dunham says, I've been lucky to get to see some great colleges and universities from the inside. There's one that stands head and shoulders above all the others in my esteem. It is not in the U.S. I'm guessing England.
Yes.
Was it Cambridge?
That is right. Yes, very good.
All right. I happen to get that one correctly. Plus, it's a very beautiful place.
It's incredibly beautiful. It's one of those European universities that they, you know, to build a building there, they spend 200 years on it. And so it comes out beautiful. In the U.S., we slap up a building in a few months. So.
And that's what it looks like.
Right.
So what was your experience at Cambridge?
Well, this was a sabbatical from Muhlenberg. That's a nice feature of teaching at Muhlenberg or other universities. They sometimes give you a term to pursue your own interests. And Penny and I both had contacts at Cambridge, so we both went and lived in England for 6 months. And I was just blown away by that university. It's, as you say, John, it's beautiful for one thing, just to live there and have that be your neighborhood, to walk by these gorgeous buildings and their towers and turrets.
You have the river, you have these flowering trees.
Oh, yes. That was just spectacular. But then you have the intellectual heritage of a place that gave us Isaac Newton, you know, the greatest physical scientist ever, one of the greatest mathematicians ever. And same school gave us Charles Darwin, the greatest biological scientist ever. And they gave us Maxwell and Tennyson and Nehru and Turing, and the list goes on and on. And on. So It was just a very special treat.
Yeah, great experience to imagine that kind of intellect, those people walking among these same paths.
Absolutely.
Where you were.
Same streets, yeah.
But centuries
just made
before.
You feel smarter just walking around there.
Just being almost in their presence,
yeah.
Right? Well, Bill, believe it or not, we've had so much fun that our time has already flown away, and we're having to count down the minutes now, just the way you had to do when you were preparing the great thinkers, great theorems, so a while ago. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse, and I thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in this evening and hearing about the history of mathematics from my guest, Dr. William Dunham, who is still in the mathematical realm now as a researcher at Bryn Mawr College, down the way a little bit from the Lehigh Valley. But it's real good to have you back, Bill, in the Lehigh Valley now, and you have some contact with Lehigh University at this point. And we're just happy to have you stop by WDIY and give us a look. This is your maiden voyage at WDIY.
It is, yes. And thank you so much, John. I appreciate it.
And I thank Neil Heaver, our Director of Operations, for his work on the board this evening. And until we meet again, remember to be gentle with your neighbor.